Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, we're going to jump right into the gut garden and the microbiome, one of my favorite topics. And this is actually also about Alzheimer's disease. A supplement that nourishes good bacteria in the gut may actually protect against an Alzheimer's-like disease in designer Alzheimer's disease mice and is going to be tested in a human clinical trial very soon. Growing evidence points to a link between Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease and gut health. Many studies have found that people who have these diseases tend to have more bad bacteria, pro-inflammatory bacteria in their gut, and less good anti-inflammatory bacteria. They also tend to have a less diverse mix, kind of an overgrowth. Think weeds in a vacant lot rather than English cottage garden. Well, we don't know which way the arrow of causality works, but Chun Chen at Emory University has given us a clue. She's added to the evidence showing that these Alzheimer's model mice have more pro-inflammatory bacteria and less anti-inflammatory bacteria. And they've also found that if you take healthy mice and you put them in a cage with the Alzheimer's-like mice, they're more likely to get Alzheimer's, even if they aren't predisposed themselves. And their gut microbes change to the unhealthy set. That's probably because they eat each other's poop, but nevertheless, it's interesting that the bad bacteria can thrive in those healthy mice. Chen and the colleagues then used a prebiotic supplement, basically a special kind of fiber, called R13, which is designed to promote a healthy mix of gut microbes. And the mice treated with R13 were less likely to accumulate a protein called beta amyloid in their guts. Beta amyloid builds up in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, forming very nasty, sticky clumps that interfere with brain function and actually lead to cell death. R13 has recently been granted an approval in a clinical trial in humans to see if it helps with the Alzheimer's disease. So I looked it up on Wikipedia. It is actually a real drug. R13 is a small molecule flavonoid, orally active, which is cool, potent, and selective against something called tropomyosin receptor kinase B. This is the main signaling receptor for brain-derived neurotropic factor, which is also called neurotropin. This is that thing that you can increase with exercise and with fasting that's thought to be a potential treatment of Alzheimer's disease. So R13 was developed because there was an earlier drug that had similar effects, but it worked in rats but not in humans. R13, however, is readily converted in human livers microsomes into this property. So basically it goes into the blood, goes through the liver, gets converted, goes into the bile, and gets into the gut, where it has beneficial properties for the microbiome and also probably is increasing that brain-derived growth factor. Wouldn't it be lovely if we had a drug that could keep us as smart as we were when we were in college? That would be awesome. Story for you about the microbiome. Fecal microbiota transplant, effective for irritable bowel syndrome. Let's talk about that. This is the largest and best study to date of fecal microbiota transplant treating irritable bowel syndrome. And the quality of the donor stool is an important factor here. So if you don't have good poop to start with, you can't improve poop. This study looked at 200 Norwegian patients who met the Rome 4 criteria for irritable bowel. And that would mean that they had abdominal pain at least one day a week for 3 months, associated with two things. Defecation either changed the pain, either for the worse or for the better. They had a change in stool frequency, and they had a change in stool appearance. So that's all it takes to have irritable bowel, according to the scientific criteria. They'd put these people on a 12-week course of dietary manipulation, and they took a stool sample at the beginning of the study. They then randomized them, because the diet didn't work, to placebo, a 30-gram or a 60-gram fecal microbiota transplant. And they gave this by upper endoscopy. So basically, they stuck a tube down through the nose, down into the stomach, probably got to the small intestine to get around the acid. And then they dropped the poo specimen, a couple of ounces of healthy poo. Who was the donor? A healthy, non-smoking male who had only had three courses of antibiotics in his life. That they must have done some digging to find that person, and he ate a healthy diet. A response was defined as a reduction in the irritable bowel severity score of at least 50 points. And this study, that would have meant that they reduced abdominal pain. You can have a total score of 300, which is abdominal pain, bloating, and satisfied with your quality of life. So you could have a possible 300 when they looked at the people who were treated. 24% of the people who got placebo had a 50-point or better improvement, but 77% of those who got the 1 ounce and 89% who got the 2 ounce, and remember, these people didn't know whether they got it or not, this was extremely statistically significant. And if you work it backwards and say, how many people would we have to treat in order to get this to show benefit? You'd have to treat two people to help one person. Patients reported improvements in quality of life, abdominal symptoms, fatigue, and this was all in a validated survey. So, for those of you who have lost their jobs under COVID-19 and despair of ever getting them back, for all those furloughed workers out there whose jobs are, well, maybe coming back, I have a new occupation for you to consider. Wanted, healthy, fit individuals who have had very few courses of antibiotic in their lifetime, who will eat a clean, clear, high-fiber diet. If this describes you, train to become a professional stool donor. Certain restrictions apply. And maybe we will be seeing those advertisements sometime in the not-too-distant future. Our next story is actually more of an editorial. It has to do with the high price of insulin. There were a lot of things on the docket in Congress in January and February that got knocked off the docket this year. It's obvious that a greater crisis ensued, but this is a serious, serious issue and related to people whose incomes have decreased or who have lost their health insurance. It's a life-threatening issue, and that's the high cost of insulin. You can go look at a YouTube video with Dr. Raj Kumar, R-A-J-K-U-M-A-R, if you want to learn more about this. Dr. Raj Kumar has become an expert in drug pricing and has been lobbying Congress. It's been widely reported, and you may even know this, that the cost of insulin in the United States has risen at a far higher rate than inflation. In fact, the list price, this is crazy, the list price for a single vial of Humalog has jumped from $21 in 1999 to $275 in 2019. And by the way, that's a price far, far higher than Humalog insulin goes for anywhere else in the world. One in four patients are having to ration their insulin use because of cost, which leads to high blood glucose and damage to their kidneys, hearts, and brains and eyeballs. Why? Because they can't afford their drug. Now, the current analog formulations for insulin have not changed in more than 20 years. Yet in the past 5 years, there have been only a few generics that started to appear. from the same manufacturers as the branded products, which is where those generics need to come because of the 10-year duration it takes to develop a generic from scratch. These insulins are biologicals. They aren't synthesized. They're grown, and they have to be grown in tissue culture. The patent laws that we have simply do not allow for this, and there's no regulation to prevent. Well, there was an old saying back in the late 60s called, sock it to me. And boy, are they socking it to the diabetics. This is probably the best example of how our healthcare system for insulin is broken. Doctors need to be aware of these issues. But people with type 1 diabetes are a very vulnerable population. They die without insulin, and so they have to be willing to pay a high price to stay alive. There are only three manufacturers, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi Adventis. They control the entire insulin market in the United States, and there are no regulations whatsoever to cap or control the prices that they can charge. The manufacturers continually file new patents for existing insulin products. In the case of Lantus, which is a long-acting biological insulin that you only have to take once a day, which is a huge advance, they have filed 70 new patents that provide additional years of monopoly protection from competition. The FDA has also resisted approving biosimilars and requires manufacturers to go through a 10-year process to obtain licensures. In addition, a new middleman entity, pharmacy benefit managers, who are paid by insurance companies to negotiate prices with retail pharmacies and pharmaceutical companies through rebates, benefit from higher, not lower, prices. They get to pocket the difference in your copay between the high and the low-tier drugs, and there are no low-tier insulins. The pharmaceutical companies have vast lobbying power, and the whole supply chain is messed up. There's no transparency for anyone to know about the arrangements between certain drugs on a given formulary of a company or pharmacy benefit manager. And I'll tell you from my perspective, with most of my patients, the pharmacy benefit managers change once or twice a year, it seems, for some of these insurance products. And I get a letter saying, we're going to change your patient's drugs, which, by the way, is illegal in the state of California because we've changed the formulary. And like I said, they've changed it because they make money on the transaction. Eli Lilly launched something called authorized generic insulins back in 2019. And Novo Nordisk has a My $99 insulin program, which is supposed to have a huge impact, but it hasn't. Indeed, in December of last year, this never made the newspapers, Elizabeth Warren and Senator Richard Blumenthal issued a report. They surveyed 400 pharmacies nationwide, and they found that 83% of the pharmacies did not stock the authorized generic Lispro insulin. And two-thirds of these pharmacies said that they could not order this product. It was not available to them through their supplier. What is going on? A pharmaceutical representative says that, quote, the senator's paper failed to identify the system's challenges that have inhibited the access to this lower-priced products. Payers determine an individual's premiums and copays, which are subsidized by rebates that the pharmaceutical companies pay. And many payers prioritize these rebates to lower premiums instead of offering lower copays for chronic medications such as insulin. So what I'm hearing is that the insurance companies are diverting the rebates to themselves to quote-unquote lower premiums. Well, that's a laugh. I think anyone who has to pay for their own health insurance would agree with me there. Only 1 in 4 people using Medicare Part D have coverage for insulin Lispro, and only 1 in 5 in commercial plans. That's crazy. Furthermore, the industry spokesperson, who's a woman named Barnheiser, says, cutting list prices would significantly disrupt access to branded insulin, which thousands of insured patients depend on. Launching lower-priced insulin is a less disruptive approach, blah, 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 blah. Okay, here's what we need to do. First of all, we need regulations at both the state and the federal level to protect against excessive drug launch prices through value-based pricing, the same that's used in every other civilized, at least, I won't say civilized, let's say first world nation rich enough to do this. You've got to cap the maximum price. You've got to forget about this free market concept, because it's not a free market. It's an unregulated monopoly. This is not a luxury item. People with diabetes cannot say, well, I'm just not going to buy insulin. They'll die. So you give the companies a monopoly and you put a barrier on competition. There's a word for it, something like an enforcement contract. It's not possible. I just want to say we need reforming the regulatory processes so we have approval of generics. We got to do what Canada does. And when a drug is approved in Canada or the EU, we should automatically grant FDA approval. That would short circuit a lot of expense. We have to reform the patent system and prevent this bogus patent reapplication. Capping patents at 7 to 10 years, plenty of time to make back your money, but not so much to hold the public hostage. And we need a non-governmental agency to oversee pricing, someone who is not essentially someone who's maybe funded by nonprofits and somebody who isn't appointed by the next politician who wins the Oval Office. And the rebates should go to all stakeholders, especially the patients, and not be pocketed by the pharmacy benefit manufacturers. I do want to point out that Colorado passed a bill that caps patient copays for insulin at $100 a month. That's still too high for a life-saving drug in the middle of a pandemic. Now, I shall step off of my soapbox, and we're going to talk to our caller. Hello.
Yes, hi, Dr. Don. How are you? I'm calling regarding, I have kidney disease, and I've been treating it basically with diet and exercise, cutting down salt, sugars, other things. And so I wanted to understand more about blood pressure in the kidney disease. I understand that the kidney regulates blood pressure. If the water, I guess, or the liquid, the fluid in the bloodstream, if the blood pressure becomes too low, the kidneys then cause constriction of the blood vessels and cause the blood pressure to go up. So since the COVID-19, I haven't been able to exercise quite as much since that started. And so my blood pressure started to go up. Then I started just recently started walking and going back to swimming again. And I haven't been able to do as much as I'd like, but I expected my blood pressure to come back down again. So it's been about 160 over 90, maybe 160 over 100. But prior to this, it was about 138 over 80 in the 80s.
And I gather your kidney function may have deteriorated under COVID. Is that right?
Well, I'm not going in with being tested or anything like that. I feel fine.
Okay. All right. Well, let me start with just a little bit of kidney physiology, because I think it's really, when you say the kidneys regulate blood pressure, that's true. But I think it's important to understand that that's not their only function. The kidneys are the mega filter of our blood. So as blood goes through the kidneys, it goes through a series of progressively smaller filters, a kind of ultrafiltration process with more going on. So the filter structure is called a glomerulus, and it's basically a ball of blood vessel. And the blood vessel is slightly leaky. As the blood moves through the kidney, essentially the red blood cells and the white blood cells and the larger molecules like albumin and things like that, they don't filter out. So you end up with effectively plasma going into the kidney filtration system. And as what the kidney does is it decides what to keep. So your urine has all the waste products. It may have some sodium. If you're eating a lot of salt, your body will say, I don't need all that sodium. And if you eat a lot of potassium, then you'll probably have some potassium in there. And actually, it kind of trades off. And the balance between sodium and potassium is really important. And I'm not going to go into the weeds there, just to say that's a very big deal. Now, the kidney selectively pulls things back and puts them back in the circulation that it wants to keep. So if you need salt, it'll pull salt out. If you need potassium, it'll pull potassium back out. If you don't need it, it'll leave it in the urine. The same is true for waste products as far as that goes. As long as the kidney is working properly, the waste products stay in the urine and leave your body the next time you pee. Now, in order for that filter to work, you need to have a pressure head. So ordinarily, the pressure going into the kidney is basically X, let's say, and the pressure on the other side is a little higher. Let's call it X plus 10%. And so what that does is it allows some pressure in there to cause more fluid to diffuse out of the blood flow. The artery going in and the artery going out are in a dynamic balance. And this is the thing that's really important to understand about the kidney. The kidney is actually controlling blood volume by holding on to fluid. And so if you have, let's say, a hemorrhage, maybe you got bitten by a predator and you're a caveman or something like that, or you broke a blood vessel and you had some bleeding and you put on your, primitive caveman tourniquet, but you've lost, say, a quart of blood. Blood pressure goes down because there's less fluid in your pipes, and the kidney says, oh, got to add fluid. So the first thing that will happen is that it will loosen that back end artery, the artery leaving the kidney. And so now the blood's going to flow straight through the kidney. And so you aren't going to lose any fluid. You kind of don't make very much urine. And what urine you do make is very, very concentrated. And the kidney starts working on concentrating the urine, pulling back as much fluid as it can, and keeping the blood pressure up by loosening that back in blood vessel, I think. So now you've got increased blood pressure, and you send chemicals. The kidney sends chemicals that loosen the blood vessels. But it's all designed basically to keep you alive in a hemorrhage situation. But nowadays, that doesn't happen too often. We can give you a transfusion, or if you get dehydrated, we can give you some IV fluid. But the kidney was basically designed to help us survive those situations. And when you don't drink enough and your urine turns a dark yellow, that's your kidney working. So you can imagine if you overinflate the kidney, if you run a high blood pressure through it, that's going to damage that filter. It's going to tear the filter. And that's kind of how kidney damage works. The filter repairs itself with scar tissue, but you end up with less and less filtering tissue. So we start in kidney disease, we start to see an increase in something called creatinine. Creatinine is a byproduct of muscle metabolism, and it is, unless you've damaged your muscles, it's at a very stable level, and a very consistent amount of it leaves the body because it's one of the waste products, and a very consistent amount of it leaves the body in your urine. And if you take all of the urine in 24 hours and you look at the creatinine, it should, whether there's a whole lot of urine or not so much, the creatinine is pretty constant. It depends just on how much muscle you've got, so an 80-year-old little old lady with very little muscle is not going to have as much creatinine as a 35-year-old bodybuilder male. And that's, so we have to account for that. Is the creatinine starts to rise in the bloodstream, and it should be around about 0.8 to 1.1. And when it starts to get to 1.4, 1.5, you're starting to see kidney damage. That damage may or may not be reversible. So it's extremely important to keep, if there's any sign of renal damage at all, if you've been told you have early kidney disease, which I presume you have been, you really have to get that blood pressure down. And that may mean adding more medications. You've been relying on exercise, but if you aren't able to do that, you have to do other things. Now, there's some natural things you can do. I always have people take a lot of magnesium if they aren't in renal failure, and you need to talk with your doctor before going on magnesium because your kidneys have to be able to balance it. L-arginine, which is a natural amino acid, will cause nitric oxide, which is a natural muscle relaxant of the blood vessels, just as magnesium is. So you can relax your blood vessels by increasing nitric oxide. And if you take a 3-4 grams of L-arginine, which you can buy in a powder form, that could help you. So that might be something to look at. Eating foods that have a lot of nitrate, like beets, is a good thing to do. Celery seed is a good natural blood pressure lowering agent that's very safe to use. Even high-dose fish oil has some blood pressure lowering properties. So these are all natural things. But ultimately, you may need to use one of these angiotensin drugs, which would be either an ACE inhibitor or a angiotensin receptor blockade, to go after those signals, those messed up signals that are issuing from the kidney that is essentially experiencing confusing signals from the body and is raising the blood pressure because it's getting a confused message and it's making the wrong call about what to do about it. Also, meditation, adequate sleep, avoiding stress, and if you are feeling stressed, doing deep breathing. Deep breathing itself really helps. And a diet high in fruits and vegetables. They say that if you eat 7 to 9 half-cup servings of fruits and vegetables, take 500 milligrams of calcium a day as well, that all by itself will lower your blood pressure about 10 points on the on that very, very important systolic and about 5 points on the diastolic. So those are things. That's called the DASH diet, by the way, D-A-S-H. You can look it up online. Those are all things I could offer you as advice. I hope I've answered your question, but I'm ready for a follow-up if you have one.
So sometimes there's variability, I think, unless my blood pressure gauge is off. It can vary quite a bit. I noticed that in the mornings it gets a little bit higher, which I read in indication of kidney disease. I did have to at one time take Poetin, I think it is, erythropoietin. Quite a few years ago, and I went to some acupuncturists who I didn't believe could help, but with them and some diet changes and over the years exercises, the numbers for started to get more in range into normal over the years.
Well, it's great that you're going in the right direction because most people develop a little hardening of the arteries, and that tends to send the systolic, the first of the two numbers, up. I'm going to want to take just a couple of moments after we finish our call, but just, you know, you really do need to stay on top of this. I guess my last words for you are, I don't care whether you use acupuncture, homeopathy, massage, or pharmaceuticals, you've got to get your blood pressure into the 130s over the 70s. Come hell or high water, you will be looking as you age at kidney damage, which is no bueno, and you don't want to go there. All right, so you've got to take this seriously, and this is not the moment to decide not to go to the doctor. Actually, in Santa Cruz, and I think it's probably also true where you are, the rate of transmission in medical facilities, excluding nursing homes, is almost zero. I mean, I saw data this Tuesday morning, and there have been like 5 cases of people catching COVID in a medical facility, and that would include the providers. So the transmission in medical facilities, and we've got this. We've got the equipment. We know what to do, and we have the discipline to do it. So don't go eat in a restaurant. Go to the doctor, you know, if you're scared of this disease.
That wasn't my concern. It's just taking some of the medications. I wanted to try to stay off of most medications because I don't want to be, stuck for life.
How about this? Go see a doctor, and then what they suggest. You give me a call and we'll talk about it. All right. All right. I gave you a lot of good advice. I'm going to have to go now, though.
Thank you so much. Have a nice evening.
You're welcome. Bye bye.
Bye.
So I wanted to get back to, this was Carol in Orange County, California. It sounded like this was related to vision, and vision issues are always very much at the top of my mind. So Carol writes, thyroid eye disease breakthrough treatment, Tepezza. Have you heard about the newly approved treatment called Tepezza for this distressing disease? My 55-year-old daughter has just been diagnosed with this as a result of Graves' disease. What is the best way to research this new treatment? If you have any experience or knowledge about thyroid eye disease specifically, I'd very much appreciate your input. A Thank you for all you do to help us navigate this complex and important subject, our physical health. I never miss your show. I don't always understand everything you cover, but I still manage to get a lot of helpful information, as well as many helpful insights into all the different angles of this healthcare business. Yeah, well, it's a little bit more business than I'd like, Carol. And so the drug Tepezza is worth talking about. And I'm going to start, however, with talking about thyroid eye disease, because it's really very fascinating. Graves' disease, first of all, is a disease that's considered autoimmune because your body is making an antibody. But unlike almost all antibody-related diseases, this one doesn't attack the body. It actually mimics a receptor. It actually attaches to, well, control boards in our body. And one of the control boards it attaches to is the thyroid-stimulating hormone receptor, which is sitting on the thyroid, ready to accept signals from the pituitary gland to tell it whether it needs to make more or less thyroid. That's why it's called thyroid-stimulating hormone. And we use this thyroid-stimulating hormone blood test to tell us whether we're putting people on the right dose of thyroid. And that is, it's an extremely useful test. The receptor itself, however, is getting fooled by this antibody being made in Graves' disease, and it's revving the engine. So the thyroid thinks it's being stimulated by the pituitary, so it makes more thyroid, and people become hyperthyroid, otherwise known as thyrotoxicosis, because it's like an overdose of caffeine or an overdose of adrenaline. Your heart is racing. You're sweating. You feel agitated. You can't sleep. You lose weight. So, you know, think speed and you'll have, you know, what you see in the person with Graves' disease. Another thing that happens in Graves' disease is that this thyroid-stimulating antibody fits into another receptor, a growth receptor in the eyeball. And it causes the fat that cushions the eyeball to grow, causing the eyeball to pop out and move forward. This is called proptosis, and this is the thyroid eye disease that Carol is asking us about. I have had several patients with this, and sometimes it's been treated surgically. Often it's a little bit disfiguring, but it's very inconvenient because in serious situations, the eyeball won't be covered by the eyelid, and you can develop keratitis or conjunctivitis, and that can actually damage your vision because you get, well, call it fog on the window. That's the best description of it. And then you need a cornea transplant. Not good. So this is the first real drug that I've been aware of to treat thyroid eye disease. It's another antibody. It's a monoclonal antibody called teprotumumab. And I have some misgivings about this drug because it is very, very new. And because this is an orphan disease, it was approved after two human studies. And these human studies were done for 24 weeks, which is not a very long time. And the benefit compared to placebo was a little underwhelming. And I'm not sure this is really ready for prime time. So unless your daughter is very severely affected, it might be better to wait until this thing, which is now FDA approved and out there, goes through another year or two of precautions. Monoclonal antibodies can have all sorts of unintended consequences, particularly one that is, well, let's just say new on the block, and we don't even have, it's a new of its type. So how well did it work? Well, compared to placebo, there was a 51% difference in response, but the magnitude of the response was not all that. In the placebo group, there was actually a slight decrease. And in the other group, in the treatment group, it went down by 2.5 millimeters. So the difference was minus 1.8 and minus 2.8 millimeters. So the millimeter difference over the 24 weeks was statistically significant, but I'm really having trouble loving it. We don't have any carcinogenesis data. We don't have any mutagenesis data. No long-term studies in animals, which I don't like. Your daughter probably might. Let's see, you said she's 55, so she's not going to get pregnant. This has no safety in pregnancy. And it's supposed to block the insulin-like growth factor in the retina to prevent the growth. And it sort of kind of works, but I'm not so sure it's not going to block other insulin growth factors and lead to other problems. So my advice is sit tight if you possibly can. Don't be your first on the block to try this unless you're willing to take some pretty substantial risks. This is a big unknown. I'm saying sit on your hands right now. That's our time. Thank you very much for listening. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.